Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
In the late 1980s, Ottawa's Heron Gate neighborhood was a patchwork of townhomes, apartment blocks, and some small community parks. It was the kind of place where people noticed their neighbors' routines, when someone normally mowed their lawn, when the garbage was taken out, and when their kids would be out playing in the street. And among the couples who had settled in there were Camille Joseph Clairaut and his new wife, Lise Roy. Lise had married Camille on July 4th, 1987. It was a summer wedding that, to her family, looked like a real chance for stability. Camille worked some odd jobs, including stints as a cook in some diners. He presented himself as a man with some basic skills and quiet habits. Lise, though, had already endured a really turbulent relationship. Friends later recalled some arguments, a controlling temperament on Camille's part, and a woman who sometimes seemed isolated from her social circle. Now, domestic violence was not openly discussed in that era like it is today. So what might have been kind of whispered about, like a bruise or an anxious glance that she had, sudden silences at her family gatherings, rarely translated into police reports or any kind of intervention. Behind closed doors, tensions continued to simmer. By April 1990, only 3 years after their wedding, neighbors noticed some signs of a little bit of an upheaval. And one evening, people who were living nearby reported hearing screams coming from the couple's backyard. And the sound was sharp enough that it stuck in their memory. And one neighbor later described hearing a woman cry out in a blood-curdling way, and then followed by silence. The next day, those same neighbors saw Camille moving about the property in kind of a strange way. Now, they later told the police that they saw him dragging large garbage bags towards Hetherington Park, which is a short walk from the couple's home. Now, at the time, it was pretty easy to assume that it was spring cleaning. Only later would those kind of recollections become a little bit more critical to testimony. When family members tried to reach Lise, they were met with a number of excuses. Camille told a few different stories. That she had assaulted him and then run away. That she had simply left the marriage. And at one point, he even suggested that there had been this outstanding warrant for her, which was a detail that was kind of like, stop questioning me. But with no body and no real evidence of anything, and a husband who was insisting that she had left voluntarily, the case really didn't even get started. So she had been reported missing, but on paper, she was just a missing person. But for her family, the silence of not hearing from her was completely unbearable. Like, mothers just don't vanish without a trace. Sisters don't just evaporate. To them, they felt something was really wrong, but they had no proof. But Camille, it turned out, was rather cunning in the way that he handled her remains. Years later, the investigators would learn how he had buried parts of Lee's body in the yard and others in Hetherington Park. And it was an act of both concealment that was brazenly calculated in the spaces in the neighborhoods where kids played, people walked their dogs. A neighbor that had been assisting Camille with some renovations in the basement, he reportedly unearthed what looked like a large bone. Now, Camille completely dismissed it, told the man that it was just animal remains, and the moment kind of passed. I mean, imagine you find this bone in your friend's basement that looks very much human, and yet your friend just says, oh yeah, no, don't worry about that. It's just a dog bone or something. Now, he carried on with that, thinking that maybe it was only animal bones for years. And Lee's name rarely appeared in any headlines. She was just a missing woman. It went on for years. It was kind of one of those cases that was just never really pursued at all. In the early 1990s, Camille had completely moved on with his life. He had some other new partners. He continued to work jobs in the city to have his friends and all that stuff. He was a little bit odd. Even people would consider him a little unsettling, but nothing that raised any real alarms. Lee's family, though, they were pretty haunted by everything. They had no grave to visit, no answers to hold on to, just questions that just kept coming up every birthday, every holiday, every time someone would ask about her. She kind of became, for all intents and purposes, erased by what Camille had said about her. Now, as I said, Camille, by those early 1990s, he had moved on after she had disappeared, and he kind of crafted a new life for himself. So to the outside world now, he was a single man again, free to form any new relationships that he wanted, and so that's when he met a woman named Jean Rock sometime around 1992. Now, Jean was described as a woman with warmth. She had a humor, who was someone that everybody enjoyed being around and talking to, and she just kind of fell into the rhythms of ordinary life. She had family and friends who loved her very much, and she was just searching some stability. And she had the unfortune to cross paths with Camille when he was working at a diner in Ottawa. And he, of course, presented himself as attentive and available, a man who could kind of feel the void of companionship that was missing in Jean's life. Now, what she could not have known was that Camille had already buried his first wife's body in a public park and beneath his backyard. And from the start, Jean and Camille's relationship was a little bit rocky. Friends and neighbors later described Camille as being domineering and rather quick to anger. And Jean had confided at times to her friends that she was living with someone who was abusive and controlling. This pattern of intimate partner violence had already established itself in his first marriage, and of course resurfaced almost immediately in a second, which was actually more of a common law union, but had the verbal and physical abuse that his first marriage had. And those close to Jean noticed her become a little bit more withdrawn, as if she was carrying some kind of emotional burden that she couldn't share and talk about. Now, to the outside world, in today's world, she was a missing woman, basically, in the making, though nobody knew that at that time. Well, around 1992, Jean Rock disappeared. Now, unlike Lisa's case, which had at least had some neighbor recollections of some screams, Jean's vanishing was really a lot quieter. Another woman who, according to Camille, had simply just gone away. So when relatives had started asking about her, Camille would repeat the same kind of dismissive stories that he had used with Lisa's story, that she had left him, she'd gone somewhere else, and he never really had any consistent details about it. But what became of her was even more dark than what had happened to Lise. Years later, investigators would learn that Jean had been killed by Camille and her remains disposed of near Ottawa's Rideau Canal. Now, in time when the canal was drained for some maintenance, there were fragments of remains that were recovered that would eventually be connected back to her. And it was, of course, the kind of discovery that really only makes sense in hindsight. You know, bones appearing in a city waterway unclaimed, unrecognized, and then unconnected until the investigators retraced Camille's life in 2010. So, like Lise, Jean effectively had vanished from the record. In the 1990s, when an adult woman would go missing, cases were really often dismissed as being voluntary departures. And without a body and a partner who offered very little of a story of more than her, she just left, the investigation really goes absolutely nowhere. Well, Jean's family lived with a deep feeling of loss of her absence. And unlike a sudden public murder, like a disappearance kind of corrodes hope slowly over time. Like, was she still alive? Did she run away? Was she in danger? And those questions would kind of circulate for nearly two decades without any resolution. In the meantime, Camille carried on again, living his life in Ottawa, moving through some jobs, and eventually finding himself living near another woman, Paula LeClaire, who would become his third and final victim. Now, of course, looking back, the pattern is chillingly clear. Both Lise Roy and Jean Rock disappeared while in relationships with Camille. Both were written off as having left voluntarily. Both were discovered after his third crime started to draw a little bit more scrutiny. Now, had the system flagged the pattern in the early 90s, even with two women gone linked to one man, Jean's family might have received a little bit of justice sooner. Instead, Camille had moved forward unchallenged, leaving behind two families that were waiting for answers. By 2010, Camille was living in a public housing apartment complex in Ottawa's South End. He was a little bit older now, a man now in his mid-50s with some thinning hair and kind of a slouched posture and a reputation for being a bit odd, but mostly just pretty quiet. Now, neighbors, of course, didn't know that he had already killed two women. On the 12th floor of the same building lived Paula LeClaire. She was 64 years old and described as independent, kind, and very close to her adult son, Andre. Now, Paula was not romantically involved with Camille. She was just a neighbor, someone who lived nearby in the same community housing complex. But Camille wanted what she had, her apartment. And he started to become a little obsessed with her apartment. So in the spring of 2010, Paula won a new unit in the building lottery that they had. And it was a freshly renovated apartment with a better view. It had more space. And for residents that live in public housing, apartments were pretty prized commodities. And Camille coveted it. Neighbors later told police that Camille became really fixated on the idea of acquiring Paula's new unit, and he started talking about how she didn't deserve it and how he should have been the one to move in. And behind his mild outward demeanor about it, resentment was really brewing. On May 20th, 2010, Paula had agreed to go for a walk with Camille in Fairley Park, which is just behind the housing complex. And it was just an ordinary spring day in Ottawa. She didn't know that he had something kind of already planned for her, which would be her death. So in the woods that bordered the park, Camille attacked and then killed Paula. And later he told the investigators, quote, "I just lost it. I burned a fuse. That's all," end quote. Just casual phrasing, burned a fuse, was his whole explanation for taking his neighbor's life. He dug a shallow grave and then buried Paula there. And after killing Paula, Camille moved pretty quickly to try to cover his tracks. He started to tell his neighbors this story that Paula had won the lottery, but then she had gone on vacation to Disney World. And he even said that she had given him her apartment keys before leaving because she's won the lottery. She's moving away. Well, within days, he had actually moved Paula's belongings out of her unit, dumped all her furniture and her possessions, and replaced them with his own. And he started living there, insisting that Paula had given it to him before she had gone off on this supposed trip. Now, for a number of neighbors, the story sounded a little bit odd, but for Paula's son, Andre, it was completely unthinkable. Like, his mother would never disappear like that, and certainly without ever telling him, and if she'd won the lottery, she would have shared it with her son. And so when Andre visited his mom's apartment in late May, he was pretty shocked that all of her things were gone, and that there was this man now living there, and that nobody had heard from Paula. So he called the police and pressed them to take her disappearance very seriously. And without his persistence about it, Paula might never have been added to this rather long list of missing adults that was happening in Ottawa. But Andre knew something was very, very wrong. So the police interviewed Camille. Now, at first, he repeated his story that Paula had gone off on vacation after she had won the lottery. And he managed to produce some forged letters that were supposedly written by Paula saying that she had given him her apartment. But the investigators started to grow suspicious really quickly. Like, this story did not hold up. So within days, they were really zeroing in on him, and they made searches of Fairlie Park, and neighbors recalled seeing Camille in the woods around the time that Paula had vanished. And when forensic officers had dug up the park, they uncovered Paula's body in a shallow grave. Camille was arrested in early June of 2010 and then charged with Paula's murder. Now, his confession would eventually kind of shock the investigators, but even more, not only had he killed Paula, but that decades earlier, he had also killed the two other women, his wife Lise and his partner Jean, and the arrest kind of marked the beginning of a massive reinvestigation of his past. So the police returned to the old addresses, the parks and the basements, and started searching for remains that had been buried there 20 years before. And his facade was finally starting to crumble.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
When the police had arrested Camille in June of 2010 for the murder of Paula LeClaire, they suspected that this case was not an isolated act for him. Like, his demeanor and his evasiveness and his suspicious sort of vanishing of some of his past partners all kind of pointed to a little bit of a darker truth. So the investigators reopened the cases of Lise Roy and Jean Rock, the two women who had disappeared in the early 1990s while they had been living with him. And this time, with Paula's body had been freshly discovered, the detectives refused to accept now Camille's old stories about how these women had just walked out on him. And neighbors from decades earlier started sharing their stories. The screams in the night when Lise vanished in April of 1990, the dragging garbage bags to Hetherington Park that happened the next day after she disappeared, And the neighbor who had unearthed this large bone in his basement during those renovations that had been told that it was just nothing, just probably a dog. And those recollections had kind of initially been just shrugged off, but now they had a little bit more weight to them. So they scoured the places that were linked to Camille's life. And in October of 2011, city workers that were digging in the backyard of Camille's former Heron Gate townhouse unearthed some human remains. And the forensic analysis later confirmed that they were Lise Roy, his first wife, who had vanished 20 years earlier. And other searches turned up some remains in Hetherington Park that were also tied to Lise. With some DNA analysis and some comparison, the police were able to begin building the case of how Camille had dismembered and buried her in multiple sites. And in addition, there was some evidence that connected him to the disposal as well of Jean Rock's body near the Rideau Canal. Though her disappearance had long been cold, the investigators now kind of started to see the link.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Inspector Mike Callahan with the Ottawa Police. I'm in the Emergency Operations Division and the duty inspector on charge today. The scene is going to be examined. We're going to have a forensic archaeological dig commence shortly to determine what type of evidence we have available. We are making sure that we have the expertise and the proper equipment in place to initiate this examination. And unfortunately, that's all I have at this time. You know what? I'm not able to comment on exactly what transpired yesterday, but I can confirm that there were some remains found here yesterday, and that as a result of that information, we're commencing with a forensic archaeological dig. Very time-consuming task, and to ensure that every bit of forensic evidence is captured during this search, they want to ensure that they have the proper equipment and, as I said, the expertise to make this happen. Well, the coroner has a role whenever remains are found. It's up to the coroner's office to initiate their investigation, which is parallel with ours.
And forensic science and some modern investigative persistence and the willingness of some neighbors and some family to speak out finally was able to give Lise and Jean back their voices. So in 2012, Camille Claireau appeared in an Ottawa courtroom to face a little bit of justice. Now, by then, he was charged with 3 counts of murder. So first-degree murder in the death of Paula LeClaire, second-degree murder in the deaths of both Lise Roy and Jean Rock. And on June 26, 2012, he was before Justice Lynn Ratushny, and he entered guilty pleas to all 3 of the charges. Now, his plea was able to avoid a long trial, but still had to lay out some rather disturbing details of his crimes. Now, he admitted to luring Paula into the woods and then burying her in a shallow grave. He admitted to killing both Lise and Jean the number of years before, and then that he had lived freely for years while their families had searched and grieved and worried and wondered. And the judge called his crimes stomach-churning and told Camille that his place was behind bars for the rest of his life. And he was sentenced to life imprisonment with no parole eligibility for 25 years, which is the maximum under Canadian law. So, though he's technically eligible for parole after the 25 years, the fact that his age at the time and then, of course, the brutality of his crimes would make it very unlikely that he would ever be released. Family members of the victims all told reporters that they felt both relief but also some anguish. They were relieved that the truth had finally been acknowledged, but anguish over the fact that it had taken so long and that Lise and Jean had been really left forgotten for decades.
I couldn't have asked anything more. Nothing is going to bring my daughter back.
Can you tell us a little bit about your daughter, about the loss that it's meant for your lives?
It's affected all of us in different ways. One day she's there and the next day she's gone. And we believe the lies that he told us.
At first, I felt they should have been a capital punishment because I would have been first in line to watch him suffer. He took lives from us, and now we suffer for the rest of our lives. And the father, which is my husband, John Rowe, he has suffered from this. He's not very well. He's been sicker since this happened. And there's nothing more I could do, just to be there for him.
Could you talk a bit about what the impact has been on your husband?
In exactly what way?
Well, you mentioned in your impact statement that day in and day out, we really beat up about.
Well, as you can see, we were in court this morning, and the stress was so bad that he took a seizure, and that's very embarrassing for him. He doesn't sleep well. He has lost a lot of weight. He used to weigh 180 pounds. Now he's down to 140. That's all I can say. I really don't.
Would you describe Camille Cooper?
Oh, please, someone ask me that. Please.
Now, as for Paula's son, Andre, he said outside the courthouse that justice had been delayed, but not denied. His persistence had forced the police to look a little bit deeper, and in doing so, he had uncovered the truth for the two other families as well. So for nearly a decade, Camille Clairaut had lived in prison, a man who had killed three women and hidden them in plain sight. And on January 17th, 2021, at the age of 67, he died in custody at the Pacific Institution in Abbotsford, which is in British Columbia. Correctional Services Canada reported that his death was the result of natural causes. So there were no parole hearings that were ever held. No second chance for him was ever considered. And for the families of Lise Roy, Jean Rock, and Paula LeClaire, Camille's guilty plea in 2012 was really not the end of their grief, obviously. Each woman had lived a full life before she became a victim and had finally moved into the headlines. Each family had endured years of not knowing anything. Lise's family spent over 20 years without any answers. They just kind of were forced to live with Camille's story that she had simply left and left them as well. Her disappearance was treated very casually at the time. I think the way so many women's missing cases were in the 1990s and still sometimes are. And it was only after Paula's murder, like a third killing, that the investigators were willing to take a fresh look and kind of work to find her. Jean's family also had to live in silence. She was gone for nearly two decades, and her remains were just kind of there close by, and they didn't know. And they just kind of lived in this limbo of a missing person status, as someone who's not declared dead, but they can't be confirmed as being alive. So it was Paula's son, Andre, that became kind of the driving force in exposing Camille for who he really was. His refusal to accept this lottery vacation story, which was ridiculous. I can't believe anybody believed that to begin with. And his insistence that he knew his mom and she would never vanish without a word to him. So his persistence with the police were the catalyst then for the justice that all the families got, because without him, it is possible that Camille would have never been connected to any of the crimes at all. So these families and their stories remind us that behind every court appearance and every court file number, there are actually human beings who loved, and they were loved as well. And what stands out in all of the cases of Camille is how long the pattern went unrecognized. I mean, both Lise and Jean endured abuse that neighbors knew about, and friends of them as well, a controlling, manipulative partner who isolated them and diminished them, and then it finally ended in murder. And in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, domestic violence was really often dismissed as just kind of being a private matter. And the police responses to missing adult women frequently would accept the explanation that they had left voluntarily. And that mindset created some gaps that predators like Camille could go undetected. Now, today, advocates really stress the importance of risk assessment in domestic violence cases. When a partner has a history of some coercive control, jealousy, or physical violence, that danger of escalating to homicide is really high. but they still continue to happen because they still continue to be ignored. Camille's story really illustrates the fatal consequences of failing to recognize those warning signs. I mean, this guy didn't look like a menace to society. He had jobs. He lived in his homes and paid his rent and really maintained kind of a surface level interactions with his neighbors. And the ordinariness of him and then what he was capable of doing was really rather chilling. And to do it three times to three different women, and then make up these casual lies about them walking out. I really hate the one about she went out for a walk and I never saw her again. We hear that one so much. And that anybody would believe that she had won the lottery and moved off to Disney World without telling her son anything out of was ridiculous. And by the time that remains had been identified and linked, Lise and Jean had been gone for like half of a lifetime. And Paula's son has to live with the knowledge that his mother's murder was what really cracked the case wide open. And for a lot of people, I think the death of Camille really brought little closure to anybody. I mean, he'd lived out a lot of his last days in custody, but he had lived most of his life just out and about free. And meanwhile, these women never got to have their lives. Like, Lise was someone, she had dreams and her future was stolen. And Jean was a woman who was really funny by all accounts, and she had a real warmth to her. She has left a hole in her family's lives that has been there for decades now. And Paula, you know, his neighbor, she deserved the quiet dignity of having her own apartment and that independence without some asshat coming and intruding on it. And so each of them deserves to be remembered, not as a victim of some manipulative killer, but as women who lived and laughed and loved until Camille took that away from them. And Camille, like, I guess he's not technically a serial killer, but it's the story is really more about the systems that continue to fail to connect the dots. You know, neighbors they did what the right thing was to do coming forward, but their stories just weren't taken very seriously at all. And when women go missing and their partners give these ridiculous stories that nobody can believe, and when abuse is reported or even suspected, that those moments have to be treated as urgent, because to do otherwise is just repeating history, because these cases escalate. Coercive control, there can be no history of violence in a relationship whatsoever, but if that history of controlling behavior and manipulative behavior and just that feeling that that person's identity is somehow connected to that other person, the risks of homicide are there. And I think we need to really, really consider that. I know that we can't prosecute on what might happen, but we really need to figure out some early interventions. And that was the story of Camille Claireaux, an asshat extraordinaire. And I'm going to be back again next week with another terrible, awful case. In the meantime, you know what to do with your stuff. You can sign up for the Patreon. There is still merch available. It's available on Spreadshop. If you just go to spreadshop.com and then just search for A Million Other Choices, there's some different designs there that you can put on different things if you want to. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.